welcome to The Book Report. I'm your host, Elaine Charles, who is thrilled to offer up, as Ed Sullivan would say, a really big show. Wow, that's a blast from the distant past, right? But it's the time of year when you're probably spending more time in your car and therefore spending more time listening to audiobooks. I'm sure you'll agree that so much of our listening enjoyment is dependent upon the narrator. This week, you'll hear tour de force audio performances performed by Hollywood's brightest and some great works performed by the author. Now that's entertainment. So let's turn to page one of the book report.
Traditional advertising can be expensive and wasteful. But lately, you've been hearing a lot about social media and viral marketing. But let's be honest, it's confusing. That's why you need Magic Buzz, a new marketing company so unique, we've even coined a special phrase for what we do. Socio-viral. We combine the word-of-mouth friendliness of social media, like Facebook, Twitter, together with the viral reach power of YouTube, to create the socio-viral effect. The Magic Buzz team makes sure our clients are well represented online. We recently took word-of-mouth advertising to the number one position as most productive medium for a major cell phone company. That's right. Magic Buzz produced more sales than an expensive TV campaign at a fraction of the cost. Put the power of socio-viral marketing to work for you. Visit us at magicbuzz.com. MagicBuzz.com. If you have any questions, please feel free to email us at info@magicbuzz.com. Magic Buzz, we're there when you can't be.
Academy Award nominee Samuel L. Jackson, fresh off the success of his uproarious Audi-nominated performance of the mock kids book Go the Bleep to Sleep, delivers a swaggering, darkly humored rendering of Chester Himes' classic novel, A Rage in Harlem. Himes, described by the Sunday Times as the greatest find in American crime fiction since Raymond Chandler, was no stranger to the world of crime. In his late teens and early 20s, he served 7 years in the Ohio State Penitentiary for armed robbery. From this experience, he delivers the tale of his hopelessly naive hero finding himself on the run from a hypocritical and far from heroic police force. Samuel Jackson is the perfect choice to narrate this hard-boiled story of love and crime set in richly imagined mid-20th century Harlem.
At that instant, the stove exploded with such a force it blew the door off. "Great balls of fire," Jackson yelled. He came up from his chair as if the seat of his pants had blown up. "Look out, Daddy," Amabel screamed and hugged Jackson so hard she threw him flat on his back. "Hold it, in the name of the law," a new voice shouted. A tall, slim, colored man with a cop scowl rushed into the kitchen. He had a pistol in his right hand and a gold-plated badge in his left. "I'm a United States Marshal. I'm shooting the first one who moves." He looked as if he meant it. The kitchen had filled with smoke and stunk like black gunpowder. Gas was pouring from the stove. The scorched cardboard tubes that had been cooking in the oven were scattered over the floor. "It's the law," Amabel screamed. "I heard him," Jackson yelled. "Let's beat it," Jody shouted. He tripped the marshal into the table and made for the door. Hank got there before him, and Jody went out on Hank's back. The marshal sprawled across the tabletop. "Run, Daddy," Amabel said. "Don't wait for me," Jackson replied. He was on his hands and knees, trying as hard as he could to get to his feet. But Amabel was running so hard, she stumbled over him and knocked him down again as she made for the door. Before the marshal could straighten up, all three of them had escaped. "Don't you move," he shouted at Jackson. "I ain't moving, Marshal." When the marshal finally got his feet underneath him, he yanked Jackson erect and snapped a pair of handcuffs about his wrist. "Trying to make a fool out of me. You'll get 10 years for this." Jackson turned a battleship gray. "I ain't done nothing, Marshal, I swear to God." Jackson had attended a Negro college in the South, but whenever he was excited or scared, he began talking in his native dialect. "Sit down and shut up," the marshal ordered. He shut off the gas and began picking up the cardboard tubes for evidence. He opened one, took out a brand new $100 bill, and held it up toward the light. Raised from a 10, the markings are still on it. Jackson had started to sit down, but he stopped suddenly and began to plead. "It wasn't me what done that, Marshal. I swear to God, it was them two fellas who got away. All I done was come into the kitchen to get a drink of water." "Don't lie to me, Jackson. I know you. I got the goods on you, man. I've been watching you three counterfeiters for days." Tears welled up in Jackson's eyes. He was so scared. "Listen, Marshal, I swear to God, I didn't have nothing to do with that. I don't even know how to do it. The little man called Hank who got away is the counterfeiter. He the only one who got the paper." "Don't worry about them, Jackson. I'll get them too. But I already got you, and I'm taking you down to the federal building. So I'm warning you. Anything you say to me will be used against you in court." Jackson slid from the chair and got down on his knees. "Leave me go just this once, Marshal." The tears began streaming down his face. "Just this once, Marshal. I never been arrested before. I'm a church man. I ain't dishonest. I confess I put up the money for Hank to raise, but it was him who was breaking the law, not me. I ain't done nothing would nobody do if they had a chance to make a pile of money." "Get up, Jackson, and take your punishment like a man," the marshal said. "You're just as guilty as the others. If you hadn't put up the tens, Hank couldn't have changed them into hundreds." Jackson saw himself serving 10 years in prison, 10 years away from Imabelle. Jackson had only had Imabelle for 11 months, but he couldn't live without her. He was going to marry her as soon as she got a divorce from that man down south she was still married to. If he went to prison for 10 years, by then she'd have another man and would have forgotten all about him. He'd come out of prison an old man, 38 years old, dried up. No one would give him a job. No woman would want him. He'd be a bum. Hungry, skinny, begging on the streets of Harlem, sleeping in doorways, drinking canned heat to keep warm. Mama Jackson hadn't raised a son for that, struggled to send him through the college for Negroes just to have him become a convict. He just couldn't let the marshal take him in.
That was A Rage in Harlem by Chester Himes. Want to brush up on your classics this summer? Join Academy Award winner Susan Sarandon as she performs Carson McCullough's famous Southern tale of the anguish of adolescence and isolation in The Member of the Wedding. Desperate to be part of something big, Frankie Adams, a disconnected 12-year-old, takes an overlarge interest in her brother's wedding. She even dreams of following the couple on their honeymoon. But as Frankie crosses into adulthood, she experiences the fantasy-shattering disillusionment that comes with it. For anyone who's ever felt like an outsider, and haven't we all, you'll enjoy Sarandon's creative performance.
Big Mama lay in the bed against the wall next to the door, so that in the daytime she could look out through the front window onto the ferny porch and street outside. She was an old colored woman, shriveled and with bones like broomsticks. On the left side of her face and neck, the skin was the color of tallow, so that part of her face was almost white, and the rest copper colored. The old Frankie used to think that Big Mama was slowly turning to a white person, but Bernice had said it was a skin disease that sometimes happens to colored people. Big Mama had done fancy washing and fluted curtains until the year the misery had stiffened her back so that she took to bed. But she had not lost any faculties. Instead, she suddenly found second sight. The old Frankie had always thought she was uncanny, and when she was a little girl, Big Mama was connected in her mind with the three ghosts who lived inside the coal house. And even now, a child no longer, she still had an eerie feeling about Big Mama. She was lying on three feathered pillows, the covers of which were bordered with crochet, and over her bony legs there was a many-colored quilt. The parlor table with the lamp was pulled up close beside the bed so that she could reach the objects on it. A dream book, a white saucer, a work basket, a jelly glass of water, a Bible, and other things. Big Mama had been talking to herself before F. Jasmine came in, as she had the constant habit of telling herself just who she was and what she was doing and what she intended to do as she lay there in the bed. There were three mirrors on the wall, which reflected the wave-like light from the lamp that fluttered gold-gray in the room and cast giant shadows. The lamp wick needed trimming. Someone was walking in the back room. "I came to get my fortune told," F. Jasmine said. While Big Mama talked to herself when alone, she could be very silent at other times. She stared at F. Jasmine for several seconds before she answered, "Very well. Draw up that stool before the organ." F. Jasmine brought the stool close to the bed and, leaning forward, stretched out her palm. But Big Mama did not take her palm. She examined F. Jasmine's face, then spat the wad of snuff into a chamber pot which she pulled from underneath the bed, and finally put on her glasses. She waited so long that it occurred to F. Jasmine that she was trying to read her mind, and this made her uneasy. The walking in the back room stopped, and there was no sound in the house. "Cast back your mind and remember," she said finally. "Tell me the revelation of your last dream." F. Jasmine tried to cast back her mind, but she did not dream often. Then finally she remembered a dream she had had that summer. "I dreamed there was a door," she said. "I was just looking at it, and while I watched, it began slowly to open, and it made me feel funny, and I woke up." "Was there a hand in the dream?" F. Jasmine thought. "I don't think so." "Was there a cockroach on that door?" "Why, I don't think so." "It signifies as follows." Big Mama slowly closed and opened her eyes. "There's gonna be a change in your life." Next, she took F. Jasmine's palm and studied it for quite a while. "I see here where you're going to marry a boy with blue eyes and light hair. You will live to be your 70, but you must act careful about water. I see here a red clay ditch and a bale of cotton." F. Jasmine thought to herself that there was nothing to it, only a pure waste of money and time. "What does that signify?" But suddenly the old woman raised her head, and the cords of her neck stiffened, and she called, "You Satan!" She was looking at the wall between the parlor and the kitchen, and F. Jasmine turned to look over her shoulder also. "Yes'm," a voice replied from the back room, and it sounded like honey.
"How many times I gotta tell you, take them big feet off the kitchen table?"
"Yes'm," honey said again. His voice was meek as Moses, and F. Jasmine could hear him put his feet down on the floor.
"Your nose is going to grow into that book, Honey Brown. Put it down and finish up your supper."
F. Jasmine shivered. Had Big Mama looked clear through the wall and seen Honey reading with his feet up on the table? Could those eyes pierce through a pure blank wall? It seemed as though it would behoove her to listen carefully to every word.
We've just heard Member of the Wedding by Carson McCullers.
Social media, it's got everyone buzzing these days. But what is it really, and how can you put it to work for you? More than just a passing trend that's hot today, gone tomorrow, social media is marketing that is making a difference for savvy business people who have jumped into the future. Magic Buzz is a new online marketing company so unique, we've even coined a special phrase for what we do. Socio-viral. We combine the word-of-mouth friendliness of social media like Facebook and Twitter together with the viral reach power of YouTube to create the socio-viral effect. Magic Buzz's socio-viral solution provides the measurable value of online advertising that works, affordable, and effective. So get the buzz going for your business. Magic Buzz, with only one Z, because we're never asleep. Visit us at magicbuz.com. For more information or any questions, please feel free to email us at info@magicbuzz.com. Magic Buzz, we're there when you can't be.
Once upon a time, a teenaged Kate Winslet received a gift that would leave a lasting impression. A copy of Emile Zola's classic, Thérèse Raquin. 6 Academy Award nominations and 1 Best Actress Award later, she steps behind the microphone to perform this haunting classic of passion and disaster. This is the story of a young woman forced into an unhappy marriage to a dull, sickly cousin and smothered by an overbearing aunt. When her husband's childhood friend enters her life, a torrid affair begins that sets her spirit free, but has shattering consequences. This dark tale of 19th century France brings out the best of Kate's formidable talents.
On this particular Thursday, Michaud, who had just given an account of a horrible murder, the details of which had made his audience shudder, added as he wagged his head, "And a great deal never comes out at all. How many crimes remain undiscovered? How many murderers escape the justice of man?" "What?" exclaimed Grivet, astonished. "You think there are foul creatures like that walking about the street, people who have murdered and are not arrested?" Olivier smiled with an air of disdain. "My dear sir," he answered in his dictatorial tone, "if they are not arrested, it is because no one is aware that they have committed a murder." This reasoning did not appear to convince Grivet, and Camille came to his assistance. "I am of the opinion of Monsieur Grivet," said he with silly importance. "I should like to believe that the police do their duty, and that I never brush against a murderer on the pavement." Olivier considered this remark a personal attack. "Certainly the police do their duty," he exclaimed in a vexed tone. "Still, we cannot do what is impossible. There are wretches who have studied crime at Satan's own school. They would escape the divinity himself. Isn't that so, Father?"
"Yes, yes," confirmed old Michaud. "Thus, while I was at Vernon, you perhaps remember the incident, Madame Raquin? A wagoner was murdered on the highway. The corpse was found cut in pieces at the bottom of a ditch. The authorities were never able to lay hands on the culprit. He is perhaps still living at this hour. Maybe he is our neighbour, and perhaps Monsieur Grivet will meet him on his way home." Grivet turned pale as a sheet. He dared not look round. He fancied the murderer of the wagoner was behind him, but for that matter he was delighted to feel afraid. "Well, no," he faltered, hardly knowing what he had said. "Well, no, I cannot believe that. But I also have a story. Once upon a time a servant was put in prison for stealing a silver spoon and fork belonging to her master and mistress. 2 months afterwards, while a tree was being felled, the knife and fork were discovered in the nest of a magpie. It was the magpie who was the thief. The servant was released. You see that the guilty are always punished." Grivet triumphed. Olivier sneered. "Then they put the magpie in prison," said he. "That is not what Monsieur Grivet meant to say," answered Camille, annoyed to see his chief turned into ridicule. "Mother, give us the dominoes." While Madame Raquin went to fetch the box, the young man, addressing Michaud, continued, "Then you admit the police are powerless, that there are murderers walking about in the sunshine?"
"Unfortunately, yes," answered the commissary.
"It is immoral," concluded Grivet.
That was Thérèse Raquin by Emile Zola. Donald Katz is founder and CEO of Audible, the internet's mecca for audiobooks. Audible, founded in 1995, developed the first copyright secure system for distributing audio via the internet for playback at or away from a PC. From its website and via Audible's key distribution partners, Amazon.com and iTunes, Audible serves listeners like us who seek convenient access to the best of audio entertainment, information, and education. As you probably know, Audible is not only about books, but includes daily audio digests of leading newspapers like The Wall Street Journal and The New York Times, weekly audio digests of Forbes, Harvard Business Review, Scientific American, and others, as well as time-shifted public radio programs such as All Things Considered and Car Talk. Before founding Audible, Don was a successful author and journalist. One of his books, Home Fires, An Intimate Portrait of One Middle-Class Family in Postwar America, was nominated for a National Book Critics Circle Award. Don also has served as a contributing editor for Rolling Stone, Esquire, and Sports Illustrated, to list just a few. Don, who hails from Chicago, graduated from New York University, attended the University of Chicago, and holds a master's in economics from the London School of Economics. Welcome, Don. It's so fabulous to have you stopping by the Book Report today.
Great to be here, Elaine. Thanks for having me.
Can you share the story of the beginning of Audible?
Well, you know, there's when businesses that have grown large are in retrospect considered, I've always found there's multiple genesis stories. It's never one thing. But in my case, Audible.com was an idea that came to me during a process of writing what would have been my fourth book. I ended up publishing five during my 20 years as an author before veering from the writing life for what I thought would be 5 or 6 years to start a company, because I thought it couldn't take longer than my 6 and 5 year book production cycles. But I was just researching a book 20 years ago, 19 years ago, on the digital media revolution, which at that time was so unformed, it was just a lot of talking and there really wasn't much to write about. But I got expert enough in the characteristics of what digital distribution meant in terms of the physics and things like that. And to make a long story short, I suddenly came to me that these belly packs full of tapes that I used to jog with and to listen to audiobooks, which I always thought was a brilliant and underappreciated and completely mispositioned and poorly distributed product, that you could create a digital inventory. And this is, again, this is very primitive days. And that some of the things I knew from my many book tours to 12 and 14 cities and the like, to see the problems of book distribution, the problems of the book business, would go away. For instance, you'd never be out of stock. For instance, you'd never have to go out of print. And that you could have a vast selection rather than the 200 or 300 best case tapes or CDs in the back of a bookstore. And you could optimize the price to the consumer because you wouldn't have packages and returns from the seller back to the publisher and all that kind of stuff. So that sort of started the concept. My college roommate and I, he was a supercomputer designer, and I was nothing if not an English major. And I then said to him one day that, let's figure this out, because you're going to have to get the signal of the spoken word, which is very compressible versus, you know, music and video in those days. Everything was still going through the phone lines. We need to get it off the phone or off the computer once we get the signal to people so they can take it in their cars. And at that time, I did some research and found that 93 million Americans drove to work alone. And actually, now it's 105 million Americans drive to work alone, only 119 million drive to work. So I saw this huge opportunity to fill that time with literate listening and value, which was underappreciated because of how, you know, small of aspirations the audiobook business had been. So we figured out that you had to kind of liberate the audio from the desktop. And I remember saying, well, the printer sits on every desktop liberating text, because the early discourse of the new networks was it was textual. What are we going to do? And so we invented the first digital audio player and started a company in 95 dedicated to do that and to sort of reposition and transform this, you know, slightly backwater business called the audiobook business. And we came out with the digital audio player in 1997, which people really don't have good historical memory on, either economic history or technological history, I've realized after all these years. But in 1997, nobody knew what a download was. Nobody trusted their credit card online. And this thing came out 5 years before the iPod, and was out there in a, with people literally not understanding how it could possibly work, this little solid-state device. It's in the Smithsonian now as the first networked digital device. And it's we were, you know, very proud of what we did. And, you know, and a lot of other things were behind it. And part of it was that I was always a fairly literary writer. I was part of the Rolling Stone, very long form, you know, narrative nonfiction world, and was their London guy for years in the 70s. And I also wrote books that were, you know, considered fairly literary. And, you know, I was never anything but absolutely transfixed by the power of well-voiced prose. And part of the reason was that my mentor was Ralph Ellison, the great novelist, and studied with him, and he kind of was very, you know, proactive in my writing career. And Ralph absolutely believed, as did many people in the 20s and 30s, that American vernacular, our talking, our joking, our storytelling, our ability to sell things and lament in the fields, was our talking led into the characteristic that became American literature. Fact is, when I left the writing life to start Audible and Audible.com, I was kind of attacked in the then kind of literary gossip press and the like for not only abandoning my writing, which was going really well, I have to say, I had no complaints, and but I also was abandoning text for this you know, secondary thing called an audiobook. So 17 years later, after, you know, figuratively putting my pen down, Audible.com's a great, big, very fast-growing, you know, phenomena that's exceeded my dreams of how popular, and it's got a long way to go. It's really moving up towards a position in the mainstream. I mean, right. It's way out of its backwater. Most of our members have never bought an audiobook before, have no bearing, no relationship to that nice-to-have product you bought for way too much money and then kept the kids quiet during a vacation. The average member takes 19 books per year. That's the average.
Huh.
Because they use it every single day, and they look at it as a service called Audible, and it completely fills their lives with new meaning and value.
I've been reading that Audible has an amazing new initiative called the Audible Author Services Program. Do you want to talk about that a bit?
We've started growing, and this happens all the time, so fast. You know, we keep outstripping the source of supply, as they say in business economics. You know, we grow so fast that traditional publishers, which were either the big print publishers who had relatively small audio divisions or licensing out to these great audio publishers, you know, like Books on Tape was one of the most famous ones originally, that they just couldn't keep up. So years ago, we kept trying to, you know, co-invest and basically went into becoming a producer, and now we're the largest producer of audiobooks and the most decorated producer of audiobooks. We just got 37 Audi nominations, a vastly, you know, record-breaking number, and we also have very famous actors in the studios all over the country doing this stuff just because we've got to have more content. So in this process, we also realized that when we connected directly with authors, they, because there's a new generation of authors who use social media and feel much more of a sense of helping themselves rather than ceding all their fortunes to publishers and agents who incidentally get most of the money, younger authors in particular need to kind of get over that old thing of being Victorian aesthetes, you know, living above the marketplace and letting all these other people take care of them, because they don't really have as much wherewithal to do that anymore, or the money. And the fact is that, you know, a company like Audible, we've got the millions of customers. So we just thought, how do we wake authors up to this? And last year we started something called ACX, Audiobook Creation Exchange, which is an online rights marketplace and audio production mechanism, very sophisticated, where all these, you know, actors and engineers can meet with rights holders and basically create this stuff and you know, turn these kind of dead rights to audio, which often don't get made into audio, into books. But still, it was we weren't waking them up enough. So then we started something called Author Services, where we basically said any American, Canadian, or British author with a title at Audible can come and sign up, so we can know where to pay you and tell the tax man that we'd pay you $1 a download for every one of your books at Audible between now and the end of the year, and that we'll work with you to do social media campaigns and merchandising and things like that to escalate your sales.
All right. And lastly, can you talk a little bit about the evolution of the company? What's next?
Our problems and our challenges are very kind of, you know, they say high-class problems because things are actually going so well. And really, the challenge is just the fact that with all of our growth and the size of the company and, you know, so it still is not a well-known concept that you can come to audible.com and literally, if you think you should read more, which most people do, you have a solution. And I think, you know, part of it's just being creative about getting awareness out there and letting people try it because the service sells itself. The fact is that the performances in terms of their actual quality just keeps going up, and we've become a big part of that. So on one hand, the answer is we're spending as much money as we had in revenue, in 2006 on marketing now. We're investing super heavily in content. Witness the fact that you can hear, you know, Kate Winslet and Annette Bening and Colin Firth and Dustin Hoffman and Susan Sarandon and Anne Hathaway and Sam Jackson and others doing Audible audio now if you come to audible.com.
Well, I can tell you that listening to books has changed my life, and I want to thank you so much for joining us today.
Great. Thanks very much.
All right. Bye.
Take care.
Traditional advertising can be expensive and wasteful. But lately, you've been hearing a lot about social media and viral marketing. But let's be honest, it's confusing. That's why you need Magic Buzz, a new marketing company so unique, we've even coined a special phrase for what we do. Socio-viral. We combine the word-of-mouth friendliness of social media, like Facebook, Twitter, together with the viral reach power of YouTube, to create the socio-viral effect. The Magic Buzz team makes sure our clients are well represented online. We recently took word-of-mouth advertising to the number one position as most productive medium for a major cell phone company. That's right. Magic Buzz produced more sales than an expensive TV campaign at a fraction of the cost. Put the power of socio-viral marketing to work for you. Visit us at magicbuzz.com. MAGICBUZ.com. If you have any questions, please feel free to email us at info@magicbuzz.com. Magic Buzz. We're there when you can't be.
Listening to The Book Report, your weekly resource for finding out books that are hot and some that are not. Next is Dan Rather's Rather Outspoken, My Life in the News, the memoir of one of the most preeminent journalists of our time. Rather discusses the big stories from his reporting in his straightforward, conversational manner. This personal account, written with Digby Deal, includes Rather's dismissal from CBS, the George W. Bush Air National Guard controversy, his coverage of the JFK assassination, and the origin of Hurricane Dan. He also discusses inside stories about top personalities he's interviewed or worked with over his remarkable career.
Why was I out at CBS? Because I reported a true story. The story I reported in September 2004 of President George W. Bush's dereliction of duty during Vietnam is true, and neither Bush himself nor anyone close to him, no family member, no confidant, no political ally, has ever denied it. I remain proud of reporting that truth, and proud of the many people who were part of that report. In retrospect, and with time to think about it, if shining a light on Bush's unexplained absence during his stint in the Texas Air National Guard was the story that got me pushed out of CBS, the first strong indication of trouble had come 4 months earlier over a story I reported on 60 Minutes 2 in April 2004. As a journalist, my core principle, my duty, has always been to get to the truth. This, however, was a story nobody wanted to be true. The story of how some American military personnel were humiliating, abusing, and torturing Iraqi detainees at Abu Ghraib prison. The duties of a journalist, however, do not stop with uncovering the truth. Absent compelling reasons of national security, which is very different from political embarrassment, at least it should be, journalists also have a responsibility to inform the public about the truths they discover. And my determination to fulfill this obligation about Abu Ghraib became a very big problem, and I suspect a political embarrassment for the management of CBS and for its corporate parent, Viacom. At the height of the Iraq War, I was a frequent flyer to Baghdad. From the war's beginning in March 2003 to March 2004, I'd been there at least four times. On one of the early visits, I learned that the prison known as Abu Ghraib had been taken over by the U.S. Army. Refurbished and redubbed the Baghdad Central Correctional Facility, by the fall of 2003, it was being used to house those we had taken prisoner. The inmates were a mixed lot, some common criminals, some folks who were just in the wrong place at the wrong time, and some considered to be high-value prisoners suspected of leading the insurgency or participating in terrorist activities. The name change didn't alter its reputation. Whatever you called it, Abu Ghraib was notorious. Under Saddam Hussein, it had been feared by all as a chamber of horrors, a gulag, if you will. Prisoners were maimed, raped, and tortured. Many were also murdered, or at least presumed murdered. After being incarcerated there, they had vanished without a trace. The prison was trashed and looted by the Iraqis themselves during our invasion. Americans who had seen the interior immediately after U.S. troops took Baghdad reported gruesome scenes of bodies mauled by dogs and electrodes coming out of the walls. Eventually, we would recover videotape shot by U.S. troops on the day they entered the prison. The tape showed squalor, filth, and an incredibly unsafe area for American soldiers to be living, but this is where they were housed while they worked to rebuild and reclaim the facility for use by the U.S. military. I had a more personal connection to Abu Ghraib as well. During the Gulf War in the early 1990s, Saddam's forces had captured one of our CBS correspondents, an outstanding journalist named Bob Simon. Bob and I have been friends and colleagues for more than 35 years. He is one of the best, most experienced foreign correspondents of his generation. A graduate of Brandeis University, he is brilliant, analytical, and a swift, sure writer. And he has guts. His bravery is legendary among his peers. He could have held his own with the Murrow Boys of World War II. Bob and I had been in many of the same bad datelines and tight places, often at the same time over the years. Vietnam, Lebanon, Gaza, the West Bank, Baghdad, and others. He is, as many of the best foreign correspondents are, a bit of a loner, but every inch a gentleman and a scholar. He's generous, compassionate, and friendly. Loyal and protective of those who work with him and for him, especially camera crews, technicians, and producers in the field. But he leans toward being taciturn, doesn't always talk a lot, and stays to himself and within himself, more than most people in television news.
We've just heard Rather Outspoken by Dan Rather. For fans of Tina Fey and David Sedaris, internet star Jenny Lawson, a.k.a. The Bloggess, makes her literary debut. Lawson realizes that the most mortifying moments of our lives, the ones we'd like to pretend never happened, are in fact the ones that define us. In Let's Pretend This Never Happened, Lawson takes readers on a hilarious journey recalling her bizarre upbringing in rural Texas, her devastatingly awkward high school years, and her relationship with her long-suffering husband, Victor. Chapters include Stanley the Magical Talking Squirrel, a series of angry post-it notes to my husband, and Then I Snuck a Dead Cuban Alligator on an Airplane.
I've managed to pinpoint several key differences between my childhood and that of pretty much everyone else in the entire world. I call these points 11 things most people have never even experienced or could even have possibly imagined, but that totally happened to me because apparently I did something awful in a former life that I'm still being punished for. Number 1. Most people have never stood inside a dead animal. Unless you count that time when Luke Skywalker crawled inside that tauntaun to keep from freezing to death, which I don't because Star Wars is not a documentary. If you're easily grossed out, I recommend skipping this entire section and going straight to chapter 5. Or maybe getting another book that's less disturbing than this one. Like one about kittens. Or genocide. Still there? Good for you. Let's continue. I remember as a child watching the Cosby family prepare dinner on TV and thinking how odd it was that no one was covered in blood, because this was a typical night at our house. My father, an avid bow hunter, would lumber inside the house with a deer slung over his shoulder. He'd fling it across the dining room table, and then my parents would dissect it and pull out all the useful parts like some sort of terrible piñata. It was disgusting, but it was the only life I knew, so I assumed that everyone else was just like us. The only thing that seemed weird about it to me was that I was the only person in the whole house who gagged at the smell of the deer blood. My parents tried to convince me that blood doesn't have a smell, but they're liars. Also, they told me that milk does have a smell, and that's ridiculous, and I'm shocked that their lies have spread so far. Milk doesn't have a smell, blood does, and I think I'm so sensitive to the smell of a dead deer because of the time when I accidentally walked inside of one. I was about 9 years old, and I was playing chase with my sister while my father was cleaning a deer. I'm going to interrupt myself here for a small educational explanation about what it means to clean a deer. Cleaning a deer for people who are sensitive members of PETA. You get some warm water and some tearless shampoo, and you gently massage the deer. Lather, rinse, but don't repeat, even though the bottle says to, because that's just a ploy to sell more shampoo. Blow dry on low heat and hot glue a bow on his forehead. Send him back into the woods to meet a nice Jewish doe. Go to the next chapter. Cleaning a deer for curious, non-judgmental readers who really want to know how it's done and who aren't PETA members who are just pretending to be curious, non-judgmental readers but who really want to throw blood on me at book signings. Cleaning a deer consists of tying up the arms and legs of the deer to a clothesline-like contraption, making it look as if the dead deer is a cheerleader doing the "Gimme an X" move. Then you slice open the stomach and all the stuff that you don't want falls out, like the genitals. And the poop rope. Cleaning a deer for people who clean deer all the time. I know, right? Can you believe that there are actually people who don't know this? Weird. These are probably the same people who call the poop rope the intestines. We all know it's a poop rope, people. Saying in French doesn't make it any less disgusting. Anyway, my dad had just finished cleaning out the deer when I made a recklessly fast, ninja-like U-turn to avoid getting tagged by my sister, and that's when I ran right the f*** inside of the deer. It took me a moment to realize what had happened, and I stood there, kind of paralyzed and not ninja-like at all. The best way I can describe it is that it was kind of like I was wearing a deer sweater. Sometimes people laugh at that, but it's not an amused laugh. It's more of an involuntary, nervous giggle of what the f***. Probably because you're not supposed to wear deer for sweaters. You're not supposed to throw up inside of them either, but that doesn't mean it didn't happen. I'd like to think that my father threw that deer away because I'm pretty sure you're not supposed to eat food you've worn or vomited into. But while he was hosing me off, he was also hosing off the deer, so my guess is he applied some sort of a up Grizzly Adams version of the 5-second rule. You know, food on the floor is still edible as long as you pick it up within 5 seconds, unless it's peanut butter, and then the 5-second rule is null. Or if it's something like dry toast, the 5-second rule is extended to, like, I don't know, a week and a half, because what's going to get on dry toast? Nothing, that's what. God, I should totally write a whole book about the 5-second rule. That should be the follow-up book to this one. The 5-second rule as it applies to various foodstuffs. Brilliant.
We've just heard a bit of Let's Pretend This Never Happened by Jenny Lawson.
social media. It's got everyone buzzing these days. But what is it really, and how can you put it to work for you? More than just a passing trend that's hot today, gone tomorrow, social media is marketing that is making a difference for savvy business people who have jumped into the future. Magic Buzz is a new online marketing company so unique, we've even coined a special phrase for what we do. Socio-viral. We combine the word-of-mouth friendliness of social media like Facebook and Twitter together with the viral reach power of YouTube to create the socio-viral effect. Magic Buzz's socio-viral solution provides the measurable value of online advertising that works, affordable, and effective. So get the buzz going for your business. Magic Buzz, with only one Z, because we're never asleep. Visit us at magicbuz.com. For more information or any questions, please feel free to email us at info@magicbuzz.com. Magic Buzz, we're there when you can't be.
Another Texas girl, Sissy Spacek, has just written a delightful and moving memoir, My Extraordinary Ordinary Life, not to be confused with Condoleezza Rice's book, Extraordinary Ordinary People. Well, Sissy writes about growing up in a small East Texas town with the clarity and wisdom that comes from never losing sight of her roots. Descended from industrious Czech immigrants and threadbare Southern gentility, Sissy grew up a tomboy, tagging along with two older brothers and absorbing grace and grit from her remarkable parents. With a keen sense of humor and a big-hearted voice, she describes how she arrived in New York City one star-struck summer as a 17-year-old carrying a suitcase and two guitars, and how she built a career that spanned four decades. She details working with some of the great directors of our time, including Robert Altman, David Lynch, and Brian De Palma, who considered her a no-talent set decorator until he cast her as Carrie. She also reveals why, at the height of her fame, she and her family moved from L.A. to a farm in rural Virginia. Whether she's describing the terrors and joys of raising two independent daughters or taking listeners behind the scenes on Oscar night, Sissy's memoir is poignant and laugh-out-loud funny, plain-spoken and utterly honest.
Sometimes there's no better entertainment than a town dump. When we were kids growing up in East Texas, my brothers and I would ride our bikes to the dump yard over behind the high school. To us, it was a treasure trove of free and wonderful things, and we spent hours there sorting through the piles. At the entrance, people would drop off the better stuff, things that weren't really trash, just used items that families had outgrown. That part was more flea market than landfill. Sometimes we would find old but perfectly good toasters, links of rope, used games, old toys, or boxes of paperback books. Animals were dropped off, too, in hopes that someone would give them a home. One afternoon, my brother Robbie rode home from the dump, cradling a paper sack as if it was filled with diamonds. I watched as he dropped his bike in the grass and ran into the house, holding up the bag and yelling, "I found a kitten!" My dad looked up from the newspaper. "Can we keep it, Daddy?" he asked, still breathless. I was just a few steps behind, chiming, "Can we, Daddy, please? Yeah, we need a cat," said Ed, our older brother. She was a scraggly little calico, newly weaned, with six toes on each foot. After the three of us whined and pleaded for the rest of the day, our parents gave in. Our new pet had two names. Inside the house, where she was quiet and sort of mysterious, we called her Suzette. Outside, she was Cattywampus, a freewheeling mouse and bird hunter who roamed the neighborhood in search of adventure. I've always thought of myself as a lot like that cat. My outside self was like Cattywampus, strong, sunny, competent, compassionate, funny, creative, and optimistic, heading out into the world wearing a smile and a bulletproof vest. My inside self was like Suzette, introspective, observant. The outside me was like an open book, the inside me had secrets. Nothing earth-shattering, just the deepest thoughts I kept to myself, like the cigar box full of treasures that I had hidden under my bed. Anyone else who opened that box would have only seen a collection of ordinary objects, old cat's-eye marbles, a tiny Coke bottle, a jew's harp, school photos of my little boyfriends with their awkward signatures scrawled across their faces. But to me, each object held a special significance. They were my most precious things, talismans only I understood. I buried the cigar box in the backyard one day, hoping to preserve a time capsule of my life that I could revisit when I was older. I marked out the steps and drew a map of where I had dug the hole. A few years later, I decided it was time to unearth the time capsule and remind myself of the past. I dug dozens of holes, but I couldn't find it. Never did. Maybe my feet had grown, or the map was wrong. No matter, I still carry that box around with me in my head while I collect new treasures along the way. I keep them safe in a part of me that no one ever sees. A storeroom where I sort and process the events of a long and interesting life. My mother's lilting voice is there, speaking words of wisdom. So are my father's strong, capable hands that could play a banjo or build a house. My brother's trusting smile. The laughter of my children. This safe and quiet place, Suzette's world, fuels my work as an actor and filmmaker. I know it's always there within reach, inexhaustible as memory.
That was My Extraordinary Ordinary Life by Sissy Spacek.
Traditional advertising can be expensive and wasteful. But lately, you've been hearing a lot about social media and viral marketing. But let's be honest, it's confusing. That's why you need Magic Buzz, a new marketing company so unique, we've even coined a special phrase for what we do. Socio-viral. We combine the word-of-mouth friendliness of social media, like Facebook, Twitter, together with the viral reach power of YouTube, to create the socio-viral effect. The Magic Buzz team makes sure our clients are well represented online. We recently took word-of-mouth advertising to the number one position as most productive medium for a major cell phone company. That's right. Magic Buzz produced more sales than an expensive TV campaign at a fraction of the cost. Put the power of socio-viral marketing to work for you. Visit us at magicbuzz.com. MagicBuzz.com. If you have any questions, please feel free to email us at info@magicbuzz.com. Magic Buzz. We're there when you can't be.
You're not doing it right. Michael Ian Black has been hearing these five words all his life. And now, on the eve of his 40th birthday, he is finally beginning to wonder why. As a husband and father living in the suburbs, Michael asked the question so many of us ask at one point or another, how did I end up here? The answers to these questions, and others that you probably would never have thought to ask, are painstakingly detailed in You're Not Doing It Right, Tales of Marriage, Sex, Death, and Other Humiliations. Darkly humorous and told with raw honesty, Michael takes on his childhood, his marriage, his children, and his career with unexpected candor and deadpan wit. Stories in this funny because they're true collection include how his lesbian feminist mother raised him to be a tough but sensitive new 70s man like Alan Alda, how his camp girlfriend dumped him for a guy named Taco, and how he backed into marrying his wife by breaking up with her first. A very popular comedian, Michael Ian Black says the kind of things you're afraid to admit. Here he is, naked, exposed, a little chilly, and understandably shriveled.
The thing I was supposed to be doing the day Martha asked if I had gotten any work done was writing this book. a book I had been struggling with, at that point, for over a year. The book was so hard to write, I thought maybe I should give up. Maybe, I thought, I need a career change, and these online personality tests will help me discover a new, more satisfying profession. Maybe if I just put my trust in the mighty internet, all will be well. A word of background regarding my career. At the age of 9, I decided to become an actor. Most people do not follow through on the career plans they made for themselves as children. If they did, the world would have an enormous surplus of cowboys and ballerinas, and not nearly enough directors of sales for companies that manufacture ceramic floor tile. But I am one of those rare people who stuck to his childhood job plan. As a result, I have spent the last 30 years of my life living out a career choice made by somebody who had not yet mastered the ability to tie his own shoes. Along the way, I also became a writer. In fact, the writing component of my career soon took on more importance to me than the acting, which is how I came to be writing this book, my second. The first was called My Custom Van, and 50 other mind-blowing essays that will blow your mind all over your face. That book spent exactly 1 week on the New York Times bestseller list, number 17. Not that impressive. Which is why I now refer to myself as New York Times bestselling author Michael Ian Black, whenever possible. But any magic I used to have with the written word seems to be gone now. I need a new career. Fortunately, there is no shortage of career tests on the internet. I choose one that attempts to discern the occupation you are best suited for from a series of personality questions based on the Jung and Myers-Briggs topology. I don't know what that means, but it sounds authoritative. Also, the word topology sounds like topless, which is kind of cool. Sample question. You willingly involve yourself in matters that engage your sympathies, yes or no? That is an easy question to answer. No. Because when I am at work, that is my time to work. The workplace is not the appropriate arena for us to discuss your problems. When I am there, I need to be left undisturbed to check what people are saying about me on Twitter. Very straightforward. But I find a lot of the questions difficult to answer. I mean, are my decisions based more on the feelings of a moment than on careful planning? Is a thirst for adventure close to my heart? I once went skydiving, which is certainly adventurous, but I cannot handle the tilt-a-whirl. So what does that mean? The further I get into the test, the more insulted I begin to feel. How can the entirety of my personality be reduced to 72 yes or no questions? What difference does it make whether or not I prefer to isolate myself from outside noises? Which outside noises are they talking about? Jackhammers? Yes. Bird singing? No. My children screaming? Yes. My children laughing? Yes. My children? Yes. I write down yes. Although I am dubious about the accuracy of such a test, I am still excited to get my results. The test reveals that my specific personality type is known as INTP, which stands for Introversion, Intuition, Thinking, Perception. And I discover that I am in very good company. Albert Einstein, Charles Darwin, and Thomas Jefferson were all INTPs. Huh. Perhaps this test is more accurate than I had originally thought. Surely, I too would make an excellent physicist, naturalist, or author of the Declaration of Independence. Excited, I stroll down to see which career the test believes would be best for me. The answer? Paralegal.
That was a sample of You're Not Doing It Right by Michael Ian Black. Listening to an amazing audio performance in the car makes the miles fly by. For more ideas on great performances, make sure to check my website, bookreportradio.com. Thanks so much for joining me today, and see you back here next week on The Book Report.